RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. We're at RPGLL Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, rpglpodcast@gmail.com, and check us out online at rpglessonslearned.com.
Hi, welcome to RPG Lessons Learned, the show where you can learn from our mistakes. With me, as usual, is Brian.
Yo.
And Mike.
Hello.
So today, we're talking about an adventure we ran in 5th edition quite some time ago, before Nathan even joined our group. And this was the Wild Sheep Chase. It's a 5th edition adventure by a guy named Richard Jansen Parks. He originally posted it on Reddit under his Reddit username, but he actually offers this adventure completely for free on the DM's Guild run by DriveThruRPG. So, Brian, we're going to add that link to the show notes, right?
Yeah.
And as a reminder, you can get to the show notes from rpglessonslearned.com.
Yeah, and if I was better about things, it would be tfradio.net/rpgll081. I actually really need to go back and fix all those that I haven't done.
That's all right.
Hey, also, side note, if you're listening and the audio quality isn't up to normal snuff, we're having some technical issues on Mike's side.
It's all my fault.
So I don't have the discrete tracks to work from, you podcast nerds. So, you know, you get what you get.
Yep, we've got to get one in the can tonight. All right. So quick impressions for the Wild Sheep Chase. And I'll go first. I rated it a 7. This was a fun session with some really great role play that we'll get into. Even some intra-party role play, which is something I've struggled with, as you've heard on previous episodes. But combat just took forever. Mike, what are your thoughts?
I'm really, really glad we actually had the recording of this one, which is kind of a rarity for us to go back and listen to, because on review, we had a really, really fun time with this campaign. I'm going to give it an 8, because in retrospect, I don't think the combat was as sluggish as we think it is now, as we were feeling at the time, right? So listening back to us, we had a good time, so I'm going to go ahead and give it an 8.
Brian?
I'm of two minds. Like, as a game, I want to give it an 8. I think it was, I do enjoy it. But as we pointed out, we actually recorded this one because this was from a period of time when we thought we were going to post their games to like Reddit. And that was kind of the mindset that I was listening to this from, and it was just not something we could post. So in that sense, it was a failure. So just in context of the game, I think it was a really fun game. I would say an 8, but from what I was hoping to get out of it, and it's mostly my fault, from that sense, I mean, it would be like a 3.
Yeah, you'll hear in the discussion to come, we are putting together an actual play, it would be an effort for us, is going to be an effort for us, been an effort for us. It doesn't come naturally. Playing for an audience is very different than playing for ourselves. So jumping into the topics that we prepared for today, let's start off with the characters. So you guys ran premades, which you then built on by creating relationships between those premades. Let's start with the premades. This is actually a case where, despite recent conversation, we were awesome with the premades. At the end of this recording, we talked at length about how much we enjoyed the premades, how good the premades were, even though now we're kind of down on premades. Have we grown since we ran this adventure, or were these 5th edition premades just better? I mean, a lot of 5th edition stuff is just really high quality. Which do you think it is?
I'm going to say it's a little bit of both, right? So thinking back to this pre-made compared against other pre-mades we've ran, these pre-mades were of a higher quality, right? So my druid build made sense. It made sense naturally. The only place where I was a little down on my pre-made was it not having, I think, the full spell descriptions on the character sheet. So there was a little lag time for me having to go back to an actual spell player's guide reference book to get the full spell description. But I mean, it felt like a druid build. It felt like someone actually took the time to think through make logical spell choices, logical stat assignments, logical equipment choices. And for a level four, you know, it felt good. It felt like a legit character. With that said, I think we also have grown where we don't need to rely on pre-mades a little more. And I think that we meld a little better with our characters when we roll our own.
If it's a one shot, I'm fine with a pre-gen. Yeah. If it's a campaign, I would roll my own. I mean, I played a barbarian, or I think it was a barbarian. I mean, so it's not like the character was that complex, you know, reasonably speaking. I mean, I stood there and I took hits, then I gave hits back. So, yeah, I mean, my character was fairly strong when it comes to just the mechanics of how it was written. But I mean, I'm not going to say it was the most thoughtful character ever again, because it was a barbarian.
I will say, don't sell yourself short there, Brian. You managed those rage mechanics very well.
I was always raging. I mean, it was like a free action or something. So,
but you had to maintain your rage, and we had a little bit of talk about how you can do that. But considering you'd never played a barbarian before, I think that again speaks to the quality of the pre-mades in 5th edition, where you were able to run that barbarian and run rage for the first time ever with very minimal table talk about it.
Yeah, that's true. It's just funny listening to it. I'm raging, by the way. I'm raging.
That is true. The very calm, cerebral commentary on the rage.
You know, that actually made me think of something, too. This was the first and last, but first time I'd ever actually ran a druid either. And yeah, I didn't struggle with those druid mechanics at all. So I think there really is something to be said about the quality of the 5th edition pre-mades.
So all in all, a little bit of column A, these were just better pre-mades. And a little bit of column B is that this is an older game and we have grown since we played this. So we did an exercise at the very beginning of the session where we created relationships between the characters. Basically, I had each of you, you know, define a relationship with the character to your right. We didn't roll on any charts or tables. You guys just made it up. And what did you think about that?
If I could do it over again, I would have changed things. So
don't you dare.
So I can tell by the way that I responded that, and I remember that I basically made a joke about my character being in a relationship with Chris's character. I didn't think it through. It was just a whim that I just said, okay, we are a couple. And that colored the entire game.
For the better.
Not if we wanted it to be an actual play.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But I think what made that game so much fun for me was just a lot of the irreverence, right? I mean, it was a big slog on combat, which we'll get into. But when I listen to the interactions we're having across the table, I think that twist on the characters is honestly what made this game a good time.
So let's go ahead and tackle this topic, which is that for the first time, we had an intra-party couple. So we had both you and Chris playing gay characters. Re-listening to the podcast, you guys RP'd it as an old married couple. You did the old married couple vibe hard. Before we get into the gay topic, let's talk about, is the old married couple, is that RP that only married people could do? Was it informed by your real marriage as you two played off each other?
It was informed by the media. How I've seen like old couples, played in the past. And I mean, it was nothing like my marriage. It was nothing like my relationship with, you know, Kim. I mean, so here's the thing. And it has nothing to do with the sexuality of the characters or anything. Just something people need to know about me. And I don't know that you guys have ever noticed it, or maybe you have, I don't know. But a very insightful and astute friend of mine, about 12 or 13 years ago, he and I were having a serious conversation about life and things. And he said, you live your life like you have a studio audience in your head. And that is probably the truest thing anybody's ever said about me, whether I'm with somebody else or not. I, make jokes, I, do whatever, but it's, I'm always trying to make a studio audience laugh that isn't there. I know they're not there, but I still live my life that way. So I try to perform in almost every situation, whether anybody else finds it funny or not.
So is that something that you think you'll be able to turn off to record an actual play? Is it an insurmountable problem?
So I've got to be serious, like at work and everything, right? But what I do when I'm serious at work, my humor or the jokes that I make, I tend to switch the audience and not so much switch it off. So I might have a studio audience. I might be doing a program that's geared towards teens and 20 somethings. Then I might do something that's geared more toward, an older. So I might go from a Married with Children again to God, I'm doing the Ed O'Neill thing with
to the Honeymooners,
Modern Family. Yeah. So I try to change it up based on things. Now my jokes are all just dad jokes, but my jokes were dad jokes before I had kids. But I don't switch it off more so than I tweak it.
So see, I think my problem is going to be switching it off because I don't do such a great job of switching up audiences sometimes, especially when I'm around with you guys. That's what I'm going to struggle with, is that I'm in best friends mode and I'm going to have to tweak it up to work appropriate mode.
I don't know if work appropriate is the right mode. If we're recording an actual play, which we were trying to do with this game, which is why this topic's coming up. If we're recording an actual play, it needs to be fun. People listen to the podcast to feel like part of the friend group, to feel like they have these friends who share this interest, while they're whiling away time on their commute. That's why I listen to podcasts. I'm still to this day am hugely embarrassed by waving at DM Scotty as if I knew him at Mace, because I'd watched so many of his videos and I'd listened to so much of what he had to say. When he walked into the room, I felt like I knew the guy. And maybe there are people that feel that way about us. So it doesn't need to be humorless. It doesn't need to be totally locked down, HR, work appropriate. But we did make a lot of off-color jokes. And we're transitioning into this topic a little awkwardly from the relationship that your character had with Chris's character. What? So I don't want it to come off like these were gay jokes.
No. Well,
these were just off-color jokes, and a lot of them did stem from things that couples might comment on about each other.
So I think this blurred the line a little bit. So it started off, it was just ha-ha gay jokes, we're gay characters. And not in a disrespectful way. It's like I have a lot of gay friends who make the same – God, that's just the most pandering.
Some of my best friends.
But I have friends, it's kind of – I'm kind of catty. I'd say I flirt with my gay friends, but I will make comments that would be considered flirting if they didn't know that I was 100% heterosexual. But it was kind of like that where it sort of started off that way as, just sort of kind of mimicking the gay friends that I have. But it did the characters really started to develop this old married couple vibe, and Chris and I were really playing off of each other. And it sometimes it involved, jokes that were, two people that have been intimate for a long time. But other times it was kind of sweet, really. I was actually kind of impressed in the end. But I made a note in my notes that I was really disappointed in myself at the beginning. Why did I go there? But by the time it was over, I was pretty happy.
We're hugely blurring two topics here.
We are.
Let's just talk about the relationship for a second. The relationship that your characters had. Look, first question. Was it fun? Did you have fun with it?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think Chris had fun with it?
Yes.
Why? Why was it fun?
It was a chance to channel something from our personalities that we don't normally get to do. I mean, it's not like you get to say these kind of comments. Again, going back to catharsis, you don't really get to say these kind of comments, in polite society or at work or in most situations. It's like Mike said, we were going into best friends mode and all of us are having fun. And that just happened to be the venue or the avenue that it took. And it became this improvisational sort of exercise between the two of us. And we were really playing off of each other. And it was just a lot of fun. I don't get to do stuff like that often, and I thought it was pretty great.
So I think it helped make the game because it gave your character and Chris's character this great, you know, piece of material to work with and play with. And at no point in the game did you guys shut each other down on it. It was constant. You were constantly yes-anding each other, and it just kept that dynamic going, and it made that game fun. I think in retrospect, if you guys hadn't had that character arc, that game would have been boring as hell.
And it wasn't just like, you know, the fact that we were, you know, two gay characters, two gay men. It was almost like trans species as well. So, my character's name was Pug, and I basically played him off like he was a gigantic pug, like the dog, or at least he looked like it. I don't even remember what kind of, creature he was, but in the game, like we basically said, he looked like a dog, and we played around with that as well. And, it was a lot of fun. It really was. And he was a drow. I was whatever I was. And
so I think the orientation of your characters had nothing to do with this fun. I think the fact that you had this strong relationship with another character at the table, and you had two players that were really open to making these jokes, that are in, you know, comfortable marriages, that have seen these sitcoms, that have been were able to play off each other and have this fun sitcom experience where you're recreating this nagging couple from Modern Family or from what's that Fox show that you referenced earlier, Married with Children, or The Simpsons, or what have you. I think you had a ton of fun with that. And I don't want to mix that with the off-color comments, because I think those are two different topics.
They are, but so there's jokes, then there's the off-color jokes. And I guess I wasn't speaking so much to the off-color jokes. There were a couple. It's kind of like there's a meme that gets passed around. It shows like the difference between, you know, a new couple and an old couple. The new couple has like them embracing and kissing, and it's like very passionate. Then the old couple has like one spouse like looking at a bump on the butt of the other and saying, "Hey, it looks like it's gotten smaller." That's the kind of characters that Chris and I were playing.
You were,
yeah.
And I think that was great. And I think you guys were performing. You made us laugh. You made me and Mike, the other two guys at the table, laugh with your performance. I think it was a good performance. I'm glad you had fun. I think it was tastefully done. I think that part was fine. The couples, the gay couple, that was fine. What I don't think was fine, and what the actual play couldn't tolerate, were the off-color jokes that you guys made. Like an old married couple in a sitcom would do about, you know, performance or bedroom humor coming into to the nagging humor. Basically, I'll just say it, dick and fart jokes. A ton of dick and fart jokes where it was really tough to have a serious moment in the session. And I don't think that had anything to do with character sexuality. It was just dick and fart jokes being made at the table. Because it's the end of a long day. It's after work. We're all in a goofy mood. It's releasing tension. I don't know what the purpose was. Well, let me just ask that. Why are we making these jokes? Is it the thing with the audience in your head? Were we breaking tension? Are we just the products of a Mystery Science Theater 3000 generation where anytime anyone says anything remotely suggestive, one of us has to say, "That's what she said"?
Well, that's what she said.
All of the above, and that is what she said.
Yeah, also, I think part of the drama or the seriousness also was broken a bit by the fact that I love that the sheep in the game. We had basically a stand-in, which was Dory, which is Mike and Liz's dog. And you could hear Dory. The sheep ended up being named Dory by the end of the game.
Yeah.
But so that, you know, that was going on. And then was it Marley?
Yeah, Marley.
And Marley was also, Marley made it into the game. That was Mike's character's bird who was responding. I think that sort of made the situation comical to begin with. And it was just so easy to fall into the trap of making jokes.
Yeah, so we sit down and we say, "Hey, we're recording this for an actual play." We've got a dog barking. We've got a bird going nuts in the background, chirping like crazy. We've got a dog's bell going. Everyone's telling the dog to get down. I mean, just nothing about that recording could ever be released, both in terms of audio quality and the dick and fart jokes.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I remember, like, man, I would, it would have been nice to post that. Of course, you know, in hindsight with the dick and fart jokes, you can't. But listening back to it now, 3 years later, it was a lot of fun. I loved that, you know, Dory was in there and Mike had to deal with that. And Marley was chirping every time. Marley was freaking out. We had to incorporate that into the game. I thought that was awesome.
I think that kind of also relates back to a point we made in our last show, right, of breaking the bubble. I think my pets were breaking the bubble so much that caused a lot of the off-color humor, a lot of the quipping. Now, we do that a lot regularly. There's a few other episodes we recorded in the past that we've said we can't release because of the same off-color jokes issue, and we maybe didn't have a bubble issue. But I think that's something to be taken into account for this session.
And one more thing, and because I have to call it out. Do you think also, again, this was pre-Nathan, but Chris was in there. Do you think Chris is the difference maker? Not saying that he's the cause, but like with Chris in there, the chemistry is different. Because going back to the Kataro game, we didn't have that. Not so much.
I think it could have been the bubble. We played the Kataro game in a conference room in a quiet space. It was a quiet game in a quiet space. And I think, and also there were just three of us. So there wasn't as much of an audience. You know, if you crack a joke, you're pissing off at least half of the other people in the room, which is, you know, the DM trying to run a serious game. So it's not as easy to crack jokes. Whereas when the DM's outnumbered or when whoever, you know, when there's more of us, there's more of an audience to laugh at the joke.
That's fair.
So, long story short, we've got a tough row to hoe in trying to curtail some of our usual commentary to record an actual play because there's entertaining ourselves and then there's entertaining an audience. And right now, the off-color jokes, you know, you guys are entertaining each other and performing for each other or for the studio audience in your head and not for an audience. Let's talk about the adventure. So I ran the Wild Sheep Chase almost exactly as written right off the page, and it ran great. And I don't run adventures off the page. I have talked in episode after episode about how when I try to run adventures as written, it's terrible and I shouldn't do it, and I should write my own stuff. The only other adventure I've ever run right off the page was Dusk, which ran, again, which great right off the page. Could you tell I was running this, you know, directly from a pre-written adventure? Did that come across?
Only when you mentioned it. In fact, I think one of the comments I made in the game was I had thought I had thrown the game off the rails pretty early by initiating combat unexpectedly with the first antagonist we ran up against. And so I kind of thought you were just making it up as we'd gone along because I had successfully derailed the game.
I mean, honestly, I'd forgotten about you running it from a pre-made adventure until later on in the game. You're talking about how one version of the game had wolves and the other had gorillas. And I'm like, oh yeah, Dusty said this was, you know, a pre-written adventure. I mean, otherwise it just felt like you were, you know, just crafting it yourself.
So you guys followed the arc of the adventure really closely. You met the sheep, you got the scroll, got to speak with animals, you found out the sheep was a polymorphed human. People came to collect the sheep, you fought them, you wound up back at the wizard's tower. You ran basically scene to scene just as the adventure was written. And I was going to ask you guys if you felt free to act or did you expressly cooperate with the arc? It sounds like you felt free to act. It's just the arc pulled you.
Yeah, so one part when the guy showed up to collect the sheep, we didn't let it play out. We just said, okay, Mike was like, okay, roll initiative, which surprised me a little bit because I think normally we would, you know, try to interact and, you know, try to avoid that. We made the decision that we just wanted to roll initiative and go, and I thought it worked great.
And I loved Mike's RP in that scene where he was the druid. He loved animals. And no, you were not going to get the sheep to harm it. That was decisive. And decisiveness is always good in RPGs. So, Theater of the Mind. This was our second Theater of the Mind game. And this is the first one that was a normal adventure because our first Theater of the Mind game was the prison escape. And that was anything but a normal session. This was a normal session, a normal adventure, and we ran it Theater of the Mind. Mike, is this the session where you fell in love with Theater of the Mind?
I'm going to say yes, because when you listen back to the comment or to the combat, you can tell that we're going from player to player to player a lot faster than we would have in map combat, right? So, you know, it's somebody's turn, you know, if the map, they're going to stand up, they're going to lean over the map for a little while, they're going to look at some angles, they're going to, you know, count out six spaces, no, count back five, count out four spaces, no, count out, okay. And then, you know, it's, you know, you're playing Risk with everybody's turn. They're trying to figure out how to take over Africa with their freaking mini. And that doesn't happen with Theater of the Mind. And I think listening back to this podcast or to this recording of this episode, it really, really brought that to light.
Yeah. So one part, though, at least at the beginning, it felt a little awkward. We were talking about movement speed, where we hardly, in Theater of the Mind now, we hardly ever talk about movement speed other than, you know, can I catch up?
Can I get there?
And, yeah. You know, we were specific. It was like, well, you know, my movement's 40, you know, now my movement's 30. And we were sitting there doing math, and it just felt a little out of place. But again, it was very early on for us in our careers as Theater of the Mind players.
Yeah, and I think, go ahead.
My thinking about Theater of the Mind has grown and my ability to run it. And I'm really hugely influenced by the notion of zones that comes with Fate. And you know, I've got these goblin archers in the distance. That's a zone. And in my head, it takes you two moves to get there. If you're an elf and your move speed is higher, maybe it's, you know, one move. And I run things much more loosey-goosey like that than actually quoting feet to you. But for our first Theater of the Mind game, I had actually drawn on paper, you know, the guys shooting arrows at you. I had noted how far away they were, and I was using that to track how many moves it would take you to get there. And even though it was my first Theater of the Mind, and I decided to run it in feet, it still ran pretty smoothly, even though I got better at it later. It still ran smoothly the first time using feet, all things considered.
Yeah, and I was especially impressed because I think one of the things that made movement speed especially sticky in this game was that I had an ability that cast a straight line wind that pushed players back and then pushed against them with their further movements. So for the mechanics in the game, the mechanics were absolutely requiring us to do movement speed math in terms of cubes, but then we were trying to justify that against, you know, Theater of the Mind.
So, Brian, having listened to ourselves play, would you have preferred this adventure on a map?
So it's one of those things at the time, yes. In hindsight, maybe not. I mean, we had to get there to where we are now with playing Theater of the Mind. And while it wasn't necessarily as comfortable, I could tell, listening back, it's just, again, it's just a step that you have to take. It's an evolution that you have to go through. And would it have been more satisfying at the time? Yeah. But I'm glad we did it because, you know, we are much more competent players now than we were.
So I'm a guy who tends to like the original thing he was exposed to. When I'm first exposed to a concept, the original version of that concept will be my favorite and everything else will be judged from that. For example, my favorite Power Rangers are Voltron. The first time I'm exposed to a concept, that's what I fall in love with. My first D&D actual play podcasts were the Penny Arcade podcasts, where they played in fourth edition, and despite it being an audio only medium, they played on a grid. And they would say things like, okay, I move here, I move there, I move here. And even though it was my first experience with an actual play podcast, and I judge all other actual play podcasts from those, all that stuff with the grid kills me. And if we're going to play actual play, it has to be Theater of the Mind. It just plays so much better. The audience can follow it because it's all verbal. There's no, wait, where am I? Here? Yeah, no, you're right there. Okay. And the audience is like, well, wait, what does here mean? What's going on with that? I think it made the game a lot easier for us to listen to, even if we can't release it because of the jokes.
I would absolutely agree with that. Totally. I mean, I don't know how you would even go about doing an actual play on the grid. I think that would be so frustrating to listen to.
it would have to be video. You'd have to stream it like Critical Role.
Yeah, and we're not doing that. We're fat.
No.
I don't want to be on video.
So, combat. Christ, combat took forever. Combat was 80% of the session. I just did some back-of-the-napkin math. It was roughly 2 hours of combat. It was two combats. Each combat was a little over an hour long. The actual gameplay in the recording was about 2.5 hours. So, 2 of 2.5 hours, that's exactly 80% of the session spent on two combats with half an hour of role play connecting it. That's too much combat. But listening to the recording, it sounded like we were engaged. Were you guys engaged by this?
So I actually made a comment at the end of the game that I loved combat and it was fast and furious and wonderful and great. And I can only think that I said that comparing it to fourth edition, comparing it to, you know, the older editions we played where combat was truly, truly a slog. I think problem with combat here was that we just weren't hitting. We weren't hitting and we weren't getting hit. We weren't meeting ACs. So we slugged it out with like three or four guys for an hour.
And it was whiff, miss.
Listening to it, it's obvious that we weren't frustrated. But if I had to do this today, I would hate myself. I couldn't do it.
And I think a lot of it, we weren't getting frustrated with it again because we were having fun with the characters. I think that's also where a lot of the cross table quips started coming into, where we were getting a little frustrated with how long the combat was taking.
So Pathfinder was no better design. I mean, in fact, fifth edition's later. It's a later version of D20. It should be better designed. But combat didn't feel like it took that long. Were we just better at taking our turns more quickly?
I think our characters, I don't know. I wanted to say maybe our characters were a little more simple in Pathfinder. We didn't have as many things to bring to the table, but then I'm the only one in this game that I felt had, you know, a complex character with a lot of weird mechanics that required looking up and figuring out and all that. I mean, I don't know if you disagree, but I would say, you know, your barbarian was pretty simple, and Chris played a rogue, and he knows how to play a rogue, so he didn't have to look anything up. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm genuinely perplexed.
So someone listening is like, what? Pathfinder simpler than 5th edition? In all fairness, if you listen to our show, you know that we played the beginner box flavor of Pathfinder. And we did a 1-5 beginner box only campaign. So, yeah, I think Pathfinder in the beginner box was, maybe it was simpler. Maybe you're right. And I also think we've tried other systems since, where combat's just really fast. I mean, my God, World of Dungeons, the only thing I don't like about it is magic, is the wizard. Everything else about World of Dungeons is awesome, and holy crap, combat was fast. I just think we've tried other systems with different thought processes that aren't obsessed with simulating combat, and it's just, it's faster and more satisfying, and you can get to the meat of the adventure, which is the story. So I'll say this about combat too, though. So the difficulty, the good of the combat. You guys were challenged by this. Re-listening to this, Chris went down in the first session. Brian, you went down in the first combat. Brian, you went down in the second combat. Everyone was low on hit points in the second combat. It was pretty rough. You guys took a lot of damage in that first combat before you even hit the bad guys. Combat was challenging. 5e, in 5e, I successfully challenged you guys all the time. Listening back to it, was there tension? Were you afraid of a wipe? Were you afraid of losing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, I think the only reason we didn't wipe is that I got super lucky and critted twice in a row in the third combat encounter. And we took a long rest between the first and the second combat encounter. How long has it been in a campaign since we've actually said the words, let's take a long rest?
And it's interesting, too, going back and listening to that, we didn't understand the mechanics so much because, you know, we didn't realize, you know, what we got back, what we didn't. And it's, again, it's just one of those things where if you don't play something all the time, you don't you lose the mechanics. And I think by the end of Pathfinder, again, the beginner's box, I was really comfortable with how everything works. But now if I was to go back and play Pathfinder or D&D 5e, I would be asking questions all the time. I think the specifics around that was around hit die and how that works with long rest.
So you guys haven't played 5th edition since it was either the Avengers game that I ran for you guys or the L5R game. And then we played other systems. That's been well over a year. I haven't played 5th edition since Mace last year. So I haven't played 5th edition in almost a year, which is ironic because 5th edition, by far and away, the most books I own for, well, I probably own more books for Pathfinder and more books for 4th edition just because it's been out longer. But I've got a ton of 5e material that I'm not running right now. Anyway.
Yeah, the only books I've really made an investment in are the 5th edition books. So
that we haven't played in over a year.
Yeah.
What you gonna do?
Yeah.
What you gonna do? All right, the ending. This the ending could be accurately described as a downer. I let it end on a downer. All of the people that had been polymorphed and enslaved to this, you know, mad apprentice, you killed them all. And the little sheep person, the little sheeple you were trying to help, you wound up accidentally killing him too when you tried to use the polymorph wand to change him back. You turned him into a gibbering mouther and then had a tough combat at the end where you had to kill him. And to your point, Mike, you got lucky or you guys would have wiped. So total downer ending.
What was the solution?
Rolling higher.
I failed the intelligence check. So yes, this was a downer because it was all my fault. I was the only one who could understand the sheep. I was the only one who could relay the information.
You could read runes. Is that the reason?
And I could read runes. And I got the wand. And we, being me and the sheep, both felt confident that I had the skills necessary to unpolymorph him. And when I rolled my intelligence check on the wand to be able to successfully cast the spell, I rolled a one.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was all my fault.
That's funny.
But we let the dice fall where they may. Do you wish I'd hand-waved it, or is failure the spice of play?
No, I loved it.
You love that we failed miserably?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so what does it take away from us? Does it take money out of our pocket?
No.
Yeah, it doesn't do anything other than change the flavor of the game. And the fun of the game, for the most part, is the actual game itself and not the conclusion. Sure, the conclusion can be a downer. The conclusion can color things. The conclusion could potentially save a bad game, but I don't think that a middling conclusion is going to save ruin a fun game.
In fact, I'd forgotten. Until I listened to the recording, I'd totally forgotten. In my head, you probably saved him.
Yeah, I thought that too.
Did you remember that? So Mike, you listening to it? Was it a surprise to you when he turned into the monster? I was like, oh, I started to remember when you failed the intelligence check.
Yep. And then I kind of had those same emotions flood again. It's like, oh, this is all my fault. But, you know, I say I like it because if we were continuing this campaign, if we were continuing those characters, that would have given my character a huge, you know, emotional background where he now had to carry around with him, you know, he's this now failed druid who not only harmed a sheep, but harmed a human all in one go because he wasn't good enough to cast a freaking spell.
And you all survived. So I don't know if it's that you failed as much as it is that you just didn't succeed. Yeah. Like, this was not a huge one-sided victory for the forces of good triumphing over evil. You know, you fought, you survived to fight another day. You ended the danger to this town of this mad mage. You just didn't 100% achieve all the side quests or all the bonus goals, which were, you know, saving the polymorph people and saving the sheeple.
It was a big spoonful of feels bad, man, and that's okay.
Yeah, fair enough. So, long conversation about this game. What lessons have we learned? What lessons can we take away? Brian, I really enjoyed the byplay that you and Chris had, but you regret your joke about your relationship. What would you change? What lesson did you learn?
I just flippantly just said, oh, yeah, he's my boyfriend when given the choice as to how defining the relationship with you know, the other character. I wish I'd have been more thoughtful. I think in the end it worked out because through that like improv, and I love improv. It's honestly a shame. I've never gotten into it because I thoroughly enjoy it. I wish I'd have just been more thoughtful. I mean, that's my main complaint, right? About so much of my gameplay in the past, whether it comes to mechanics or RPing, I wish I was a more thoughtful player. And I've become a more thoughtful player in the last couple of years, I think. I hope. A lot of it through the podcast. But at the time, I was just somebody who wanted to, pick up a piece of paper, some dice, and play. And one thing I didn't get out, and this isn't a lesson, I'm sorry. I know that I've missed the last couple games with you guys, but listening to this really makes me miss using real dice in a game.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for sitting around a real table, using real dice, and really looking each other in the eye. I think our actual play recordings, despite the fact that the audio may suffer for it, they need to be in person so that energy comes across. I think that energy and reading a room and all that and hitting on all cylinders, I think that's so much more important than perfect audio quality from recording separately on really nice microphones.
Totally agree.
So lesson, I guess. So what you're saying you regret, Brian, you regret being flippant when creating the character.
Yeah. Yeah,
because that was the butterfly effect. That was the flippant moment. And then now you had to own that moment for 2.5 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it turned out okay, but it could have just been so much worse. I could have completely botched the game, or maybe the worst of all, I might not have revisited what I said at all. And it would have had nothing to, no impact on the game. As it is, I'm happy with how it turned out, but I wish I'd have been just more prescriptive in how I handled things.
For me, a big lesson learned is the bubble. We talked about the bubble in the knife to meet you game. Mike, you made a great point talking about how the bubble was messed up by Dory and Marley barking and squawking respectively in the background, and how that freed us up to joke, and then a lot of the jokes burst the bubble. I think the bubble is going to be really important to an actual play, and has been important to a satisfying, dramatic game. So we're relearning the bubble lesson. Any other lessons you guys would add?
Not that I can think of.
There's something there about combat, and I'm turning it over in my head. What lesson did we learn? We had a great time in the session. We didn't walk away from the session learning any lessons. We walked away from the session having learned two things. One, we can't record at Mike's because of the animals. No offense, Mike. We can't record at my house because of my daughter.
None taken.
So we learned we couldn't record at Mike's house. And we also learned that we have to really curtail the dick into our jokes. That's what we learned walking out of your house after the game. Having listened to this, I think my takeaway is play lots of systems. We had only played D20 when we recorded this. Do you realize that? We had not played any D100. We had not played any Apocalypse World, 2D6. We had only 100% played D20 for our entire RPG careers at the point when we recorded this. We didn't know how good some things could be, how far the technology of RPGs had come, or what alternatives were, even. So I would say, there might be things that you're nose blind to that you don't even realize it until you play another system. So I'd really encourage folks out there listening to try some other systems. You might not love the whole system, but you might take away some pieces and thoughts and ideas. And there are some things that I would do very differently, even in 5e, to make this combat move more quickly. All right. All in all, good episode, guys. Thank you so much. And thank you all for listening.
People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.